So the new physics says we look at the human body and we see the human body as a physical machine made of atoms and molecules, but the quantum physicists reveal that underneath that apparent physical structure is nothing more than energy, that we are energy beings. Then that means that we interact with everything in the field. And this has a really important impact on healthcare. For example, when a patient comes in with a symptom into the doctor's office, there's a tendency to focus on the patient and say, what's wrong with you? And then try to look at the physical character of that patient to see what's wrong with them. The problem with that is that the patient doesn't live in a vacuum. The patient lives in an environment where other people, family, job, and other things that are going on in their world are present all the time. That quantum physics reveals that energies are always entangled with each other. So the concept of reductionism, which the medical doctor is practicing by taking the patient into his office and then looking at him and taking him apart mentally and physically by looking at his parts and trying to see what's wrong with them, the concept of reduction works if there was just a physical material universe. But as we saw in an energy universe, waves are always flowing through and interacting with everything. So all of a sudden, the concept of reductionism doesn't really apply because you can never separate somebody fully from the environment that they live in. So it's interesting because to really understand what's going on with a patient, you may have to ask questions that are not related to the presence of the patient in the room. You may have to ask questions, well, how's your married life? What's going on in your job? What's going on in your community? Why these are important is because these energies are affecting the physical character of the patient. Interesting point. When looking at the transfer of information, a physicist by the name of McClare in England tried to ask a simple question and say, if cells can respond to physical things like chemicals and drugs and hormones and growth factors, and cells can interact with energy waves and vibration, is there a difference in the reactivity or response of the organism to whether the signal was a physical signal such as a drug or the signal was a wave signal such as a vibration? And the interesting part of McClare's work, it revealed that energy signals are about 100 times more effective in conveying information than our physical signals. And why this is really relevant is conventional biology doesn't pay attention to the energy or the invisible stuff because it's basically Newtonian in its outlook that the universe and everything in it is a mechanical material machine. And yet quantum physics says it's the invisible energy that is more important. And even the physicist said that the invisible energy is 100 times more important in conveying information. So what we're really beginning to recognize is that there's an invisible world that we haven't dealt with in regard to understanding the nature of our health. And that is, we must understand the vibration. Again, that brings in these things such as energy healing, prayer, which is a form of vibration, feng shui, all of these outside kinds of things that were more or less woo-woo or new agey, actually become, in terms of quantum mechanics, very important contributors to the state of the planet, the environment, and our health, and must be considered when looking at the response of people in the world that they live in. So what we're beginning to find is that the concepts of conventional medicine, which were basically the Newtonian concepts of focus on the matter, use reductionism, and then you'd get an understanding through determinism, where if you understand the physical matter, you can control it, gives way to completely different understandings when perceived of through quantum physics, which bases on energy. So materialism gives way to energetics. So in other words, rather than focusing on the matter in quantum world, we focus on the energy. In the mechanical world, we said we could understand everything but reductionism. But in the newer quantum understanding of the universe, we have to understand holism, meaning this. Well, you can separate one marble from another marble. You can't really separate one energy vibration from another energy vibration. Since the physics world is really trying to emphasize the role of vibration, then what we really have to recognize is that in the world that we live in, we are entangled in an unfathomable number of energy vibrations, and we are connected to all of them. So in trying to understand the nature of a patient or a person's health, If you just focus on the physical, you miss the energy. If you just focus on the person, you miss the influence of the field. So we are going from a concept of reductionism and coming into a more holistic nature of studying the fact that everything is one whole, and we have to consider ourselves and our role in life in regard to where we are going to go. The last step in conventional Newtonian physics was determinism. It says if you understand the matter, you could take it apart through reductionism and understand how they work, then you could put the pieces back together, control the pieces, and determine the outcome. And that has always been the strongest part of Newtonian physics, that you could predict the outcome. And by being able to predict it, that means you could always get there. The problem is, in quantum physics, when we let go of matter and get into energetics, let go of reductionism, get into holism, we also buy an important third component, and it's called uncertainty. And it's work derived from Heisenberg, who was one of the architects of quantum mechanics, and revealed the fact that you can never fully determine anything. That as much as you focus on one point of something, other factors we lose understanding about their preciseness. So in other words, in trying to study an atom, we know that it moves and it moves through space. So there are two things you can study: the velocity of which the atom is moving and where it is in space. And as Heisenberg's uncertainty principle revealed, well, you can study one of those two and get a very precise answer. I can precisely tell you how fast the atom is going, its velocity. But the moment I precisely tell you the velocity, I actually lose the ability to tell you where it is in space, so I can't tell you where the position is. In contrast, I could focus on the position of the atom and more accurately identify where the position of the atom is. But the moment I do that, then I lose the ability to identify the exact velocity. What the point of quantum physics says is this: the concept of determinism is not likely to occur. And the reason is this: we give rise to uncertainty. You can never fully define anything. And this is where the big problem comes in our medical industry, because we take all these drugs based on experiments that presumably are going to be deterministic. Yes, you take this drug, you get this result. And we find that only a certain percentage of people get that result. Lots of people have no result or side effects to these same drugs. And the point is, aha, we can never fully determine anything. We live in a world of uncertainty. The more certain we are, the more off base we actually become. So the new physics says we must stop and reconsider how we look at life, that it is not a material universe, that everything is based on vibrational energy, that vibration is the core of everything we call material in the first place, that vibrational energies interact. Vibrational energies can change each other through interference patterns such as constructive and destructive interference. So the net result is, wherever you are, you're being influenced by fields. And if you are oblivious of the fields, then you may not ever understand why certain things may happen in your biology or not, because they're actually happening from invisible sources. And so we really have to let go of our Newtonian belief that we can, you know, determine everything and control everything and dominate nature, and really come back to the more natural theology approach that said, just basically learn the patterns as best you can and live in harmony with it rather than by controlling it. And by doing so, we would be far better off today than the world that we've created, where we have taken our deterministic pursuits and changed the environment and changed ourselves and actually have precipitated the sixth mass extinction and our own demise. So there's a comeuppance here, and it really comes down to understanding the nature of the field, and the field is the environment. And just so we get clear on what I'm defining as the environment, it is everything from the core of your being to the edge of the universe. That is the environment. It includes everything around you in close proximity to you, as well as the planets and the sun and what's going on in the entire solar system. So we are part of this entire field. It's interesting, because to really summarize the significance of this, let me give you a quote from Albert Einstein. The field is the sole governing agency of the particle. In Einstein's quote, the particle is matter. And what he says is the field, the invisible energy, is the sole governing agency of the physical reality. And this is the lesson that we really have to take home with us from quantum mechanics, because the field includes not just the things that appear physical, but our thoughts are part of the field. The energy we radiate is part of the field. The energy that comes from other living organisms and other non-living organisms, things that are not alive, physical things, also have energy. Everything is giving off energy. These constitute the field, and they determine the nature of the particle. And it's interesting, because that takes me right back to the late 1960s, when Irv was sitting with me and I was putting the cells back into the dish. He actually stated that when he said, "Remember, when you come back and look at the cells, if they're not well, before you try to mess with the cells, try to understand the environment that you put them in." So for me, that's a real exciting, wow, after all those years, I find out that that piece of wisdom was so profound, because it really gives us the nature of physics and the relationship of our health, that we must begin to understand it at that point, that we are determined by the field. In regard to the vibrations that we actually are involved with, as I talked about, yes, all the things around us are vibrating, that we are also giving out vibrations, but I also mentioned that through our mentation, we are also adding vibrations to the field. Now, it's interesting, because when we talk about brain activity, we frequently discuss it in terms of what we call EEG, electroencephalography, which is where you attach wires to a person's brain, well, through the skull or by touching the skin on their head, and then these are electrodes that read the activity of the underlying brain. And the reason why this is effective is because as the brain works, it works as an electrical system. The nerves are the equivalent of wires carrying current. And when they carry a current, you can actually pick up some of the current that's conducted from the brain through the skull and onto the skin. And so you can read brain currents by putting electrodes from the EEG apparatus on the skull. But what's interesting is that there's another technology that reads brain activity, but it's not electroencephalograph. It's actually called a magnetoencephalograph. So the difference between this, while the wires were reading an electric current, a magnetoencephalograph reads a magnetic field versus an electric field. And it's interesting, because in the basic rule of physics, there's a thing called the rule of the right-hand thumb. And it says, if a wire is carrying a current, and you wrap your right hand around the wire, your fingers around the wire, but you have your thumb pointing in the direction of the current flow, the polarity that your fingers show wrapping around the wire is the polarity of a magnetic field that surrounds the wire. So as a current is being carried through a wire, there's a magnetic field that is associated with that current that is actually extending perpendicularly from the wire, spreading out from the nature of the wire. And that the polarity of that field, as I said, is influenced by the flow of the current using the rule of the right-hand thumb. Well, what's interesting is, while electric currents get picked up and are conducted by the skin, magnetic currents pass through the skin and the skull and are actually broadcast into the field. So this new device called magnetoencephalography is interesting, because the probe that reads the brain activity is not touching the body. The probe is outside of the head. So the significance about that is that as you're doing neurological processing of the world that you live in, including your thoughts and your beliefs and what's going on in your world, you're actually creating a magnetic vibration like a tuning fork that emanates from your head out into the field. And the significance about that is that your thoughts are not really contained in your head. Scientists are actually using this new understanding about magnetic fields, because they found that if you take a magnetic field and direct it back into the head, you can influence brain activity. This process is called transcranial magnetic stimulation. So in this process, what actually happens is that a scientist will take a magnetic field and focus it inwards into a person's head. And when they turn on the field, the person's thoughts get scrambled. They actually, some of them begin to hallucinate and see images. And so what's really interesting, it says, just as the physicist said, we are giving off energy, but we also respond to energy coming back in. So when we look at our thoughts as energy fields, we recognize, yes, we are continuously broadcasting our thoughts, and the fields are connected to the thoughts, and that we are also recipients of fields, because as other magnetic fields come in, they can alter our brain. Why this all of a sudden becomes relevant in the nature of our lives and of quantum mechanics is we go back to the quote by Einstein, "The field is the sole governing agency of the particle." If we apply this understanding of Einstein to the field that we generate with our thoughts, we can see that there is a connection wherein our thoughts as the field can give shape to the particles, which is the world that we live in. And then all of a sudden we start to see we are not disconnected little pieces moving around on the planet. We are little broadcast devices moving around, giving the field shape, and the shape that we generate manifests as the life experiences that we have. So it really turns out it's very interesting, because it's been well known for a long time, things called crowd effects or mass event effects, where you get enough people together, and if you get their thoughts coherent, major events can occur on the planet. The one I like to use in my lecture is an interesting one, because it shows the lottery in city of New York on September 11th, 2002, which is 1 year after 9/11. Of course, what was on the minds of almost everybody in New York was the anniversary of this horrible, devastating situation that occurred. And what was interesting was, being that was on everybody's mind, it seems surprising to some, but not to me, that the lottery winner that night, the number was 9/11. And what it really reflects is that people are very much involved with shaping the world they're in. Well, mass events shape mass reality. We must begin to see that we also participate in shaping our own local realities and our own local experiences through our own thoughts. And this becomes important, as we'll talk about later, because if thoughts are giving rise to the material world, which according to physics they would be doing, then we really have to start thinking about what kind of thoughts we are generating, and what is the reason for the kinds of thoughts that we generate, or where did we learn the programs, etc., because these are going to be very influential in shaping the life that we lead. So we're going to come back to those thoughts later when we talk about programming of our brain, but first we have to take a look at our second assumption. And the second assumption is that genes control biology. Again, why this is so important is because this is a belief that is being taught to elementary school students and high school students and college and graduate school students, that we all buy into the belief that genes are the factors that control our lives. And as I said, that is this really real? Well, I have to stand back and as a scientist be a little critical of the research that led to this, because there's a very important way of doing science, is that you observe things in nature and then record your observations and then try to understand how they work by generating a hypothesis about what you observed and then doing an experiment to see if your hypothesis is correct. This is not the same as coming in with an idea and then asking the world, is this idea right or wrong? So in one sense, you're open to the world showing you something. In the other sense, you're asking the world if your belief is right and then trying to do an experiment to test that. Well, the second version there is really not very good science, because you're already coming in with a preconceived notion. And what's relevant about that is, in the physics that we just talked about, one of the things that was most striking to me was when I got to the point in quantum mechanics and the study of it, are the fundamental units that make up an atom, are they energy or matter? Or in other words, are they particles or waves? That particles are substance, waves are immaterial energy. And the question is, are the subunits of an atom particle or waves? And here's what the results reveal. That if you perceive them as particles and set up an experiment to study them as particles, then the subunits of the atom appear to be particles. In contrast, if you perceive them as waves and design an experiment that measures waves and then look at these elementary units, they appear as waves. So all of a sudden, what I started to read, and it was so profound, I had to read it a number of times over and over again, and the conclusion of these studies revealed the observer creates the reality. I had to read that over and over again because the nature is, okay, I'm observing fundamental units of atoms. If I consider them particles, they manifest as particles. If I consider them waves, they manifest as waves. And the question is, yeah, but what level is my observing the universe? Does this work or does it not work? And the interesting thing is, physicists have now come to, or have actually were there in the 1920s, but it took a while for them to really come to owning the meaning of quantum mechanics. That we all collectively create the world that we live in through our observations. That in fact there was a wonderful paper in the July 2005 issue of Nature by Richard Conhart, a physicist from Johns Hopkins University. His article is entitled "The Immaterial Universe." And what he was writing was that the universe is made out of energy, and that through mentation and spirit, he claimed, and this is really wonderful because he's a physicist from the hardcore world of conventional academia, claimed that the universe is immaterial, that it's mental and spiritual in nature. And really what he is saying is what I read a long time ago. The world that we observe is the world that we create. And this is very hard for most people to accept. In fact, when quantum physics was first becoming accepted as the mechanisms by which the universe operate, the physicists in those days had trouble themselves with this because they could say, well, okay, I could see these ideas working at the level of atoms and molecules, but I can't bring that kind of weirdness into my life. So there was an arbitrary decision back in the 1920s to say, let's restrict quantum mechanics to the world of atoms and molecules and use Newtonian physics to describe the rest of the world. And that's why biology just went on its merry way using Newtonian physics. And yet we're beginning to see today work by like Richard Conhart or even Stephen Hawking recently released a paper saying again the very same thing. The universe is created by our observations, that we create the field and the field shapes the particle. So why this becomes important is that we are participating in the world and creating the world, and we have to own that our participation is involved with our own mentation, and that our mentation is not contained within our head. That's what the magnetoencephalograph study revealed, which then says your thoughts go into the field and shape the field that you live in. The big lesson, the return home lesson, is be careful of what you think or ask for, as the Asians would say, because this is what you're going to get. It's not a coincidence that we are actively involved in physically shaping the world that we experience. So it's important for us, again, to recognize the nature of the energy and our thoughts in this creation. So when we take that understanding and then apply it to our beliefs become that particular reality. So if I tell you, as assumption number two, your life is controlled by genes, and you buy that, and then you look at your history and your family and you say, geez, my father died when he was 52 and my grandfather died when he was 48 and his father died when he was 53 and you're approaching 50, you would start to get a little bit nervous by thinking, oh my goodness, I am genetically predisposed to die pretty soon. Interesting fact is that if this becomes your mantra, your thought, then you actually can contribute to this reality that your belief will actually manifest itself and that you will die. If you believe you're going to get cancer, you can get cancer from the belief. And this is a new understanding because we're beginning to realize how the nature of our thoughts is translated into our biology, and our biology is not derived from the genes, but is mediated by the genes. The genes offer potentials. That's what they offer. The genes make the parts, but the genes don't say how the parts of the body are to be used and what we should stress and what we shouldn't stress. So this new research coming from the Human Genome Project is forcing us to consider the concept of other mechanisms of control. And these other mechanisms of control are involved with something called epigenetic control. Now, up to now, when we talk about genetic control, literally we're talking control by genes. But the newest, most intensively studied leading edge of science involves epigenetic control and what is also called signal transduction. And these are new mechanisms of control that have since risen to the forefront of our science. And actually, their work was seeded while the human genome was being carried out. The project was underway. New insights were provided as to this other form of genetic control. It's a second genetic code, in fact, called epigenetic control. As I said, genetic control, literally control by genes. Epigenetic control literally means, with epi, the prefix meaning above, it literally reads control above the genes. And this is the most wonderful, exciting area of research. And it was something that I actually was working on back in 1977. But at that time, there was no name for this. This was exactly what I was identifying in my cultures of stem cells, that if I put them in this environment, they form muscle, and I put them in this other environment, they form bone. All the cells were genetically identical. It was the environmental information that was controlling the genes. The mechanism that I came to understand has since been identified officially as epigenetic control, meaning control above the genes. So we're going to describe how that control occurs by understanding how biology works.